Well, there you have it, Nina. Another dose of audio medicine from Straight Outta Combat Radio and Green Zone Hero. Fabulous interview. Scott Jackman, Jacko, down in Australia with Whiskey's Wish. Doing some phenomenal things with veterans and service dogs.
Yeah, quite an amazing, extraordinary human being. He's so humble, and I was touched when he shared about, you know, not feeling good enough, and he was willing to sacrifice his life just because he recognized, you know, the life that he had and what he was had been able to accomplish with his children versus some of the other people. And, you know, just I was just touched by what he had been through and the freedom that he could no longer took for granted just because of what he had seen and was able to take it back to his family. And just for the fact that he came back and, you know, yes, he had a rough time, but he was able to recognize what he went through and then started changing life. And I love the program that he started and how they've done it a little bit different and involving the recipient of the dog in the training. And just what he's doing is incredible.
Really well said. You're right. He's a humble guy, and it's motivating to hear humans like him that have worn a uniform, defended their countries, seen countries without freedom, and to come back and to have the freedom to do what he wants to do to help others. And, you know, he is humble, and he says, you know, he doesn't, you know, there are a small family down in Australia and in the armed forces, but the reality is that there's Australia, New Zealand, Canada, England, and all these countries that understand what freedom is all about, have stood toe-to-toe with us at the global level, and we've got a lot of things to hold up as far as legacies go.
Hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he shared with what happened with 9/11. He recognized right away that even though it happened on American soil, it could impact him, and he was ready to defend that freedom.
Absolutely. And, you know, in gratitude to be here in the United States of America and have the freedom ourselves to do the things that we want to do. So our heart goes out to people like Scott and Liz Jackman and their son, who is serving in the Australian Army as we speak. And I'm honored and blessed to be here with you too, Nina, on this incredible mission to diminish the negative stereotyping of our veterans.
Absolutely. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Nina. Your steely-eyed killer shadow in the night. You were born to fight. Welcome to Straight Outta Combat Radio, audio medicine by Green Zone Hero, where we honor freedom to improve business.
Straight Outta Combat Radio is the platform, the voice for veterans to share their personal stories, and we honor their wisdom. And we want to diminish the negative stereotypes of veterans.
My name is John Krotek. I'm a U.S. Army veteran, and I was an NBC NCO.
And I'm Nina Herman, U.S. Army veteran, and I was a finance officer.
We are really excited about today's guest on Straight Outta Combat. It is the first Australian Army veteran in the world to join us on our program. And I got to tell you, this is going to be a great interview. Nina's here with me. We're going to have some good content on this one, that's for sure. Who we have today is Scott Jackman, and he also goes by Jacko. Maybe he can tell us a little bit about that. Probably comes from the name, but fairly easy to figure out, I guess. Jacko served with the 8th and the 9th Royal Australian Regiment, deployed to both East Timor and Afghanistan, where in 2012 he sustained an injury and was medically discharged in 2013. He was diagnosed with major depression, PTSD, with debilitating back and neck injuries. After the death of his assistant's dog, Whiskey, Scott was deeply devastated. And I can imagine those dogs are like losing a part of your family. In an effort to support and assist in Scott's rehabilitation, close family and friends gave Scott the encouragement he needed, knowing that he was more than able to help and support others through his experiences, knowing knowledge and empathy. And, you know, it sounds a little bit canned there, and it's really not. I'm just very deeply honored to have Jacko here with us today and Nina on Straight Outta Combat Radio. Welcome, Jacko.
Hey, gang, guys. Thanks, John. Thanks, Nina. I haven't actually heard the word honored to be and my name in the same sentence before, so thank you very much.
God bless you, mate. You're well-deserved, and all of your buddies and the men and the women that you served with in the Australian Army, and our heart goes out to all of them. We support Australia in a big way, and we're just... we know that we have a common bond and we speak the same language. And I just can't say enough about what Australia means to the United States of America. Always been there toe to toe with us. And guys like you that actually come back, go through your own stuff, and carry on with missions to help others. You inspire and motivate all of us men in the States.
Oh, thanks for that.
So let's get started. You know, let's learn about a little bit about Australia and a little bit about you, Jacko, and your family. And, you know, growing up as a child, we heard a little bit about it. You know, who was your greatest influence?
When I was a child, my greatest influence were my great uncles, who all served in either World War II or Korea. And we'd sit around at like family gatherings, and I'd sit there and listen to their stories and probably sneak a glass of beer every now and then. But that's where I sort of got like a great respect. Oh, plus, on my father's side, there was a lot of like his great uncles that were in World War One, and there's a lot of them on the honor roll, because I think in the whole history of that our line of Jackmans, there's only me and one of my great uncles that have ever come back from war. So it's sort of the history, it's like nearly ancient history now, but I just thought, well, that time someone else had a crack at it. So I joined the army as a reservist in 1994 to 2004 I was in tanks. So over here they call you a bucket when you're in tanks, or a tank whip. So I was with them, and then after that I joined full time as an infantry soldier, and proud to say that my eldest son has just joined the army as an infantry soldier as well. So it's carrying on our sort of a new tradition, I suppose.
Did you know all growing up that you were going to join the army when you grew up?
Yeah, I did, because it was something that I didn't do full time until I was 36, but it was something I always wanted to do. That's all I ever wanted to be, was a soldier. I had a short stint that I wanted to be a police officer, but after I got in trouble a couple of times, I changed my mind, so I got over that.
We probably got similar stories there. Well, so you decided to join the military early on then, because your family, you already had it pegged out what you were going to do.
Yeah, as a kid, like, I really looked up to my uncles or great uncles, and they were a really big influence on my life. Just thought they were great. Like, the stories they told and the mateship that they spoke of was it was really attractive to me. And then once I joined the army and experienced it for myself, like, there's no better job. Like, I'm proud of what I did and where I've been. And like, I've got the biggest family in the world. I've got brothers and sisters all over the world. I've been to Canada to the Wounded Warriors weekend, and I've got brothers and sisters in Canada. I've met some of your compatriots like on that trip, and I've got brothers and sisters in America, so, and in England, and yeah, we all keep in touch, and it's like a secret club that you got to put your life on the line first before you get to join.
Yeah, I never heard it quite said like that, but you know, that was very eloquent, Jacko. But you know what, you're right, man, there's like a huge global family, and it is true, we speak the same language, which is freedom, if you ask me.
Well, Australian, I don't know, you might need an interpreter to actually understand what I'm saying, but yeah, we do speak a global language, and like, compared to the size of your armed forces, our armed forces is like minuscule, and the soldiers that we send to war are mainly, like, initially and predominantly are our special forces soldiers, and then once they blow stuff up a bit, then they send us like RAR soldiers in, and it is a great family to be part of. But I think what I'm trying to say is that like, your family's a lot bigger than ours, and you have so many more people that go to war. I suppose you're such a bigger continent for a start, but like, what we actually put into it is a lot less than what you guys do in it. I'm always in awe of American soldiers and Canadian soldiers, because to me, they're the pointy end of the stick. I'm just the other end. I'm just the wooden handle hanging off the end.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, man, but let's not diminish it, man. If you follow the history of the Australian Armed Forces, you all have been at every major freaking engagement that has something to do with freedom or protecting our countries as everybody else. So I always, obviously you make fun of the accent, but I, you know, there might have been a time in my history that I wanted to be an Australian soldier. I don't know, but you know, every time I always thought that those guys used to wear those hats with the flap that went up on the side. And I used to say, that's pretty damn cool. You know, so y'all been there toe-to-toe with this man. So don't, you know the deal, brother.
You know what it's like when you're a soldier. You never think that you ever gave enough. Like, there's always, you know, as an older guy, when I was over in Afghanistan, everyone in my brick had young babies and that at home. So if we were to go into anything where I had to do like a search job because we were short on engineers and I'd have to pick up the mine lab and have a bit of a search, I'd always put myself in first because I kept telling my guys that, you know, I know my kids and like they know who I am. So even if I was to, you know, disappear now, at least they've got some memory and some, you know, comprehension of what I was all about and who I was, whereas your kids are just infants or, you know, weeks or only months old, and if you don't go home, they're never going to get to know you. So I always did that. And like, people say that that's sort of like heroic or something. It's not really. It's just, to me, it's just mathematics. Like, I'm older, so I'm more expendable than the young bloke, because I've lived, if I was to die now, I could say I lived a full life. Like, whereas those other guys, some of them had never even met their babies.
Wow, that's a good viewpoint. You know, when you went to your first combat zone, your first deployment, where was that? Was that Afghanistan or East Timor? What was that all about when you
first? Well, East Timor was more of a peacekeeping thing. And at that stage, I was in support company, so I was actually operating as a regimental signal officer, I suppose what you'd call it. And I controlled one of the detachments that used to pretty much move the quick response force, which was actually New Zealanders, so which was really special to me because when we had Anzac Day, I actually got to parade with the New Zealanders. So in that sense, it really was an Anzac Day to me because it was the Australian New Zealand Army Corps marching together, so that was really good. But that was like, really, that was just like a really shit holiday to Bali. So it was just like a very third world sort of country, but there wasn't a lot going on at that stage. The youth of that country probably didn't even remember the conflict that caused everything that started that war off. And I don't think they had an understanding of why we were there, and they had like a bit of a hatred of Australian soldiers. They just thought we were, you know, button in where we shouldn't. But when I went to Afghanistan, like, that was totally different. Like, you know, we found IEDs everywhere. Like, I'd say it was probably 90% training and 10% luck. But our company, we had like a whole company move to go and build a new base, like further inland.
You know, the mission in Afghanistan, was it clear to you why Australian forces were there?
Yeah, completely clear. Like, from my point of view, it was fighting for really the fact that, like, when 9/11 happened, that was like, you know, that shook the world. Like, and there have been smaller incidences in Bali and that where Australians have been killed, like civilians, and another couple of small incidents, but nothing like that. It was just sort of like anyone in the free world, you'd have to be crazy to not want to take up arms and fight for your country and fight for your freedom, because that's a growing problem in Australia. It's like a lot of these refugees, they come here, they don't assimilate. They decide to live together and keep their own laws and their own rules, which is fine. But if I was to go to their country and just speak English and wear the clothes I want and worship who I want to, I'd be, you know, put to death or kicked out or whatever. But they can come to your country, my country, Canada, and they can assimilate. They don't assimilate. They make their own little communities, and it's a horrible thing to say. It makes me sound like I'm racist, but it's just a growing problem, and it's horrible to think that what we did in Afghanistan, like, it got rid of the Taliban, but then ISIS popped up, and now it's just sort of happening all over again. So it's not like you can go to one place and just fight it. it's everywhere. It's in the communities, in sleeper cells and all this sort of stuff. You can't actually go somewhere and just fight it toe-to-toe. There's so much of it going on. And, you know, they've gone to the dirty tactics of, you know, like mowing people down in cars and things like that. Like, yeah, how do you fight that? Like, how do you face that front on and actually say, I'm going to have to nick off and get a glass of water. My mouth's getting all dry. But how do you fight an enemy you can't see?
What made the biggest impact to you in Afghanistan?
When I was there?
Yes. What was the biggest?
Probably, to me, like, well, I was pretty lucky because we didn't actually, our trip, the mentoring task force trips, and they started in 2010 and ended in 2016, and that was where we were teaching the Afghan army how to really look after themselves and do the job that we did. But we were very lucky because our trip is the only trip out of the whole lot we didn't lose a life. So, you know, like, to me, that was a big impact.
So we're listening to Scott Jackman, Australian Army veteran from Afghanistan and East Timor, first Australian in the world to come on the Straight Outta Combat Radio. And we asked him, you know, what was the biggest impact that you, you know, what was the greatest influence or impact that you had when you were serving in Afghanistan?
Actually, it was probably the locals. It was like, that was the biggest, just the different type of living, you know, like a third world country like that, and just seeing, like, they pretty much don't really value life the way that we do. It's not like it's a given that they're going to wherever they're going to when they die. And it, probably one of the biggest impacts is, like, seeing, because we had a medical facility, even though it was just a shipping container with a stretcher in it, that was their medical facility, that we used to look after a lot of the locals. They'd bring their children in, and it's really hard to sort of sit there and watch someone sew up a child's hand that's just had three fingers blown off it because he's been learning how to make bombs from his father, and then, you know, send him back out again. And those sort of things, and just the whole, their culture, they don't have any respect for women or even children that are girls, like, because we had some come in, like, they just take no care of them. Like, the boys are the ones that they really foster and groom, and the girls are just really nothing. Like, I think there's like three babies that I saw that, you know, they'd tipped a boiling pot of water on their head, you know, playing near the stove, and had no hair. And we were treating these babies and everything. And then a few of the police checkpoints got blown up. And I suppose that was like probably just, even though it sounds silly, like, the death part of it didn't really worry me. Like, that didn't even, like, I've seen dead bodies before, that didn't worry me. But, like, pain that these people can take, because they don't have, like, the medicines and everything that we have. We get a headache and we're off to bed and take two Panadol or two aspirin or whatever. These people are, like, nearly at death's door lying there. And, like, some of the police, they when they can't find a vein to cannulate, they just use a needle that you put in a drill, and you drill it straight into their leg bone so that you can tap straight into their leg. And these people didn't even flinch. Like, if it had been me, I would have been squealing like a pig and throwing out some Aussie slang that you wouldn't understand but probably get the gist of. But, yeah, just saying, like, a culture of people that just sort of live so hard, and, like, for the innocent ones, like, they were threatened with death and everything else from the Taliban. Like, they had to grow poppies and not grain, or they'd burn all their crops down. We got shot at a couple of times by some farmers that had obviously been told that if they didn't, you know, fire a couple of shots at us and have a go at trying, because it was sort of like a big prize for them to get an Australian soldier. If you could kill an Australian soldier, that was sort of like a big win. And, yeah, like, a lot of, they were misguided in a lot of ways, because a lot of the IEDs that they planted, they didn't even tell the locals. So we found, you know, blown up people where they just ridden down the road on their little scooter or motorbike and driven over an Italian anti-tank mine on top of a YPOC full of homemade explosive. And, like, they didn't even have respect for their own community. They didn't care what they did as long as the end result was that they possibly kill a soldier, whereas they killed probably more of their own local people than they did any soldiers.
Would it be fair to say that absolutely no concept of freedom? Would that be fair to say that they...
No.
Yeah.
Spot on. Exactly. They've never had freedom, so they don't know. They just don't know what it is. And I think because they're so cut off and they don't have... it's sort of like Chinese whispers. Like, they listen to the locals and the, you know, all the rumors floating around that the Australians are killing and raping their women and all this sort of stuff. And it gives the locals a fear of, you know, we're here, like, same as the Americans, the Canadians and the Dutch and everyone else, like the British, we were all there to help. But because of all the propaganda that spread, it's sort of like they're wary of your help and they think you're going to hurt them. So, yeah, they don't know what freedom is.
Wow.
Now, how did that impact you personally? You know, your life, you saw so much over there. Now that you've returned and you're home, how did that change your life?
Well, when I was over there, it was just like job on, so I didn't really sort of reflect on it that much. But when I got back, it's probably like every soldier that comes home and the kids go, oh, we've run out of ice cream. And it's sort of like, because I didn't realize I had PTSD, then I just like do my head in and I'd be like, what, you haven't got enough ice cream? I saw kids that don't even have fingers and they couldn't even hold a spoon to eat ice cream. And then, you know, like stuff like that. But it wasn't until I came home and remembered and well, I still have trouble sort of assimilating into like what I call civilian life. Like, and to me, it's hard because the kids over here, and I suppose it's the same there, they're used to having freedom and pretty much getting whatever they want. And it was just a big, just probably the gap between cultures was probably the biggest thing that I noticed. And probably, I still reflect on it a bit now because it just sometimes, you know, my younger son will want a new phone. And I think, well, you know, there's kids over there that probably just want to get fed. So I don't know. It's not something that I thought about while I was there because I was there to do a job and that's the only thing I thought about. So
when you got back to Australia, how were you treated? Was it like a great homecoming or did you just get kicked out or what was going on?
Well, it was for me because I was up for promotion and before I did the promotion course, I went to get some like painkillers that like a severe pain in my shoulder and I couldn't run or anything. Like it just hurt no matter what I did. So I went there and then found out that the discs in my neck were bulged and pressing on my spine. So after that, it was like you were treated nearly like a leper from soldiers that hadn't deployed because you couldn't do anything and they just sort of look at you like, oh, you're just putting it on to get out of stuff and disheartening, I suppose, that because you were going to be medically discharged, that everyone, it's pretty much like they give up on you and they don't really understand what it's like to be, like, this is the job that I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So, you know, in a sense, it was my life. I just lived and breathed army and then to be told that you can't be a soldier anymore because you've been injured whilst you're doing your job, like, it's very disillusioning and that caused me to start drinking and abusing my prescription meds and stuff like that. And we're lucky enough now that I think the culture's changed a little bit and they have like special parts like Soldier Recovery Center where they send soldiers to, you know, in all stages. Like some of them will go back to their units and some of them will be discharged, but they do get a lot of different organisations in to talk to them, like helping with coping mechanisms, like teaching them how to put their claims in for DVA and how to go through the process of trying to live a bit more of a normal life when you get out. And I suppose Whiskey's Wish is probably part of that in a way, because we go and talk to the soldiers that are getting out and try to be like early intervention with the dogs that we supply, like as service dogs to them, to try and stop that, like the family breakdowns and like that the year of, I call it the year of shit, because I just, you know, I gambled, I drank, smoked weed, abused medication, and you don't know until someone sort of says, like, if you don't stop drinking, like, I can't be around you anymore, and you start to realize that, you know, like, shit, like, this whole year's gone by and I could lose my family.
When did Whiskey come into the picture?
I discharged on the 21st of August 2013, and I got him in October of that year, and I had him for 12 months, and he died on October 7th, 2014. Unfortunately, he'd had a T-cell lymphoma, and he was my assistant's dog, and he had a T-cell lymphoma, and he passed away, and then everything went to shit again. So, you know, like, this dog had saved me. It stopped me from drinking and doing all these things, and got me back out sort of walking around in public and going shopping and getting groceries. Nothing major, like, but I took him with me everywhere, like absolutely everywhere. And when he died, the group that I got him through didn't actually provide support or any empathy of any kind, and that really sort of, it was nearly like being, you know, like pushed out, and it was like another kick in the guts to me, like when I got kicked out of the army. I wasn't kicked out, I was medically discharged, but to me it felt like, when I got Whiskey, like, it gave me part of my life back, because before that I used to sit in, my wife would go to work and the kids would go to school, and I'd just go back to bed and just drink beer until she got home, and then I'd probably drink something else to finish it off, like spirits or whatever. But when I got Whiskey, I had a reason to get up. I had to look after this dog. I had to toilet him. I had to make sure he was exercised and all that sort of stuff. And he really made me, it's not like he forced me, but it made me actually get up and start being part of the family again.
Definitely a sense of purpose again, you know. So from what I understand, my own personal experiences, you know, when we're all in the military, we have that sense of duty and that sense of purpose. And then, you know, you lose that life dream and you come back and, you know, you go through that year of shit, like you talked about, Jacko. And then you come on with a mate, a four-legged mate that gets you back on track, and you lose him, kind of throws you back. But, you know, that experience with Whiskey definitely did change your life. And we're so inspired by what you're doing now. Tell us how did that transform into Whiskey's Wish?
Well, when he died, I had my wife and a few friends around. We're actually very lucky. I should send you some photos. We had a professional photographer that's actually one of our friends, and they came around to take photos of Whiskey. We didn't actually know that he was going to die the next day, but they took it. It was the day before he died, so... And that was on my wife's birthday, so I'm pretty thankful that he died the day after her birthday. It would have been a horrible thing to remember that on her birthday, but I get off track here a bit sometimes.
Ah, you're good.
Yeah, my brain starts wandering that little... Oh, I've got my wife reminding me. Yeah.
I got one of those.
Yeah, like a lot of wives? Or
no,
a
no,
lot
just
reminding?
One of, no, a wife that reminds me, you know? It's a good thing.
I'm worried about you. You know Nina's sleeping habits. You've got many wives.
Jacko, come on, man.
Yeah, it's a bit long. I'll get back on track. It's all right.
No, it's all good.
When Whiskey died, we decided, a couple of days later, or it might have been a week later, I can't remember, but it was just, we thought, well, because they'd let me down a little bit, or a lot really, they'd sort of, it was like getting kicked out of the army all over again. So what we did was we said, well, bugger it. We're going to form a group that supports the veteran from the time they get the dog or the time that they start training the dog all the way through to accreditation and then beyond. So we support the families when
they have troubles, or and we advocate on their behalf. So we're a group that has, we started off, we were going to do one dog in the first year, and then we had a 5-year plan. So it was like in the second year, maybe three, the third year, five, fourth year, 10, and then in the fifth year, we're going to do 24. And we're 3.5 years old now, and we have 70 dogs in the program. So it sort of blew out a bit, but it's really good because it is like a family. It's sort of like being in the army again, but we provide dogs for veterans, first responders, and correctional officers. And they're all pretty much of the same mindset. Like, they don't get in there. And we have a training that we hold in Brisbane, and there's about 20 people come to that. But the rest of our dogs are all around Australia, so we do remote learning. So if they require advice or anything, they send training logs and videos, and I assess them. I became a dog trainer and did all the relevant courses to do that. And I pretty much guide them and mentor them so that they can work with their dog to get that accreditation. So firstly, they have to become like good enough to have the public access right, so they have to do the in-training jacket test, so that gets them to a standard that I'm happy that they'll go out into public and not, you know, muck up or have an accident or anything. And then after that, then they have to work towards the federal accreditation that we also do. And then what it is other dog programs, they train the dog, the recipient or the client, as they call them, because they're paying money, or pay up to like $30,000 and they get a ready trained dog. And, you know, that's all good and well. But with our program, we try and engage the recipients in the training process. So there's a lot closer bond. It gives them something to do because they're training their dog and they actually get to be part of that experience. And I think it increases the bond between the dog and the person because they're spending all that time together, and half the time they don't even realize they're going out in public to do the public access training, and they're just so focused on each other. And it's beautiful to watch some of the people that wanted to take their own lives, and now they're actually out in public and they go shopping. You know, it mightn't be anything great, but they'll go for a walk in the morning, stop at a coffee shop, go get a paper, or just duck into a shop to get some milk or whatever. And it's only those little things, but even Liz said, like, when I had whiskey, she didn't know what was going through my head at the time until then. When I got the dog, I had purpose. So then she could go back to work. Like, she was pretty much home most of the time because she didn't know what I'd do. Like, I'm drunk all the time. I could be up on the roof adjusting the TV antenna. Who knows? I just might have a – we were living in a two-story house at the time, so I think she was a bit worried.
Yeah,
that
heck yeah. I'd be worried too. You know, I know Nina had a question here somewhere. She was –
Well, a couple of questions. So how long does it take to go through the training?
It takes between 12 months, 18 months to 2 years to actually achieve the full accreditation. With our program, we do supply some of the dogs and help source them, but early on we found that if we owned the dogs and then we gave them to people half, like, trained to what we call the red jacket standard, where they go into to continue their training into public access, we found that people would give the dogs back. But when it's their own dog, they pick their own dog and they've got it from a puppy, or they may have had it from a puppy and then they apply. We'll take dogs up to 3 years old. So some of the veterans might have a dog that's 3 years old and they'll come into the program with that dog. I just temperament test them and make sure that they're okay. And we do contract some trainers because obviously I can't be everywhere in Australia at once, and they are guidelines. So we employ them to train. So it can take up to 2 years, but that could depend on the person. If they're not, you know, don't want to go out in public, it's really hard to sort of, because some of them have the dogs, but it just makes life easier for them at home because every dog's different. They're there to mitigate their injuries and their mental injuries as well. So as a service dog in Australia, the dog has to perform three tasks, like to mitigate their disabilities. So they're things that can be trained at home. And with that, actually, I always tell them.
Yeah.
Tell us specifically what the service dog can do.
Well, it varies between, you know, like between veteran, but okay, so a service dog can be, can wake a recipient from a nightmare. They can lead them out of a crowded situation because they can feel the anxiety in the person. They can jump up and pour at a person if their blood pressure is starting to drop. There's over 400 tasks that a dog can do. We have one veteran that's in a wheelchair and her dog does the washing and loads the washing machine and picks up the pegs and all that sort of stuff. So someone that's able-bodied, we wouldn't teach their dog to do the washing, obviously do it themselves. So there's deep feeling like getting an anxiety attack and the dog will jump up and or lean on them. We actually have a St. Bernard in the program whose owner has dizzy spells and faints. And the St. Bernard actually runs in front of him and takes his whole body weight as he falls down. So it's sort of like, but that, a lot of that's instinctual. Like some of those things, you can put a command to it, but it's actually the dog and the owner that have that bond and understanding of each other. And a lot of that's instinctual, like waking up from nightmares, the deep pressure therapy where they can actually, if you got someone that's restless and thrashing around in bed, they'll lie on their legs. Some we can teach them to, you know, teach them to sweep a room or the whole house, like teach them to turn the lights on if someone's got a great fear of going into the house not knowing what's there.
That's incredible. I never knew that there were 400 plus tasks that dogs could do. I mean, talk about an intelligent animal.
Now how are you funded? How are you supported?
We're self-funded and. Now we're lucky that we get some donations from the public, but we're not in no way government funded. The government hasn't come to the party. They don't get me started on the government.
Well, how can people help? How can we help? How do people get donations to you?
Well, on our website, we have a donation button and it's like got PayPal and all that sort of stuff on it. But, you know, like I didn't come on your show to try and raise funds. It's more awareness. Like, and it'd be the same there in the States. Like, people don't understand what these dogs do, and just educating the public not to, you know, make whistly noises or, you know, clicky noises to try and get the dog's attention. When that dog's doing a job, it's providing a service for its recipient or its handler or whatever you want to call them. And you don't distract them. You don't run up and pat the dog. You wouldn't go up to someone's seeing eye dog and just start patting it while he's walking across the road because he's doing a job. But people don't. And then you've got the added problem of jacket cheats where people just want to take their pet out. So they just grab a coat offline and chuck it on their dog. And, you know, there's all these other factors and people that abuse these sort of things that, it makes it really hard for the, especially for the veterans. Like, you know, Bobby Henline, he's got his dog and it provides him a service so that he can go out in public.
Well, we hear what you're saying, you know, that you didn't come on the show. And we know that you didn't come on the show to solicit for donations. But the reality is, and we talk about this all the time, that we can't do anything unless we have that donation. And so don't ever, and you know this, Jacko, don't even think for one second, man, that you need money. We need to help you find the money so you can continue on with the freaking great work that you're doing, brother. Because that's what it's about, man. You know, how can people help you? Let's get the government to wake up.
If you want to put it that way, give me money.
Be careful, man. I don't have much. No. I might just do that. Be careful. No, but let's get these governments to wake up. I mean, you're doing tremendous work, Jacko. Are you freaking kidding us? Come on, man. Let's see how we can help even more. This is a global program. Tell us how we can help Whiskey's Wish. We want to help. We want people to hear what you're doing.
Hang on. Liz is writing something down, so she must want me to say something. She's hiding in the background.
We love Liz. Hey, Liz, and thank you for your son. You know, God bless him.
Yeah, she's hiding behind the camera. Hang on. Oh, actually, that's a good idea. You could have just said it, Liz.
Come on, Liz, let's go. Yeah,
they can help by, we sell merchandise, so T-shirts, beanies, hats, pens.
Tell us, where do they get those? The website?
You can get them online on our website, www.whiskeyswish.org.au.
Yeah, don't forget the .au, because I know some people have looked for it. It does pop up, but it's got to be .au. So there you go.
Yeah, because we're whiskey from Australia.
So www.whiskeyswish.org.au. Whoever's
Did you say org?
No.
Hey, come on. I'm starting to worry about you, you know, about everyone's sleeping habits. You've got many wives, and now you're having an orgy.
No, isn't it? No, it's not that, is it? But let's, you know, if you're listening out there, they need help down in Australia. We need to get Whiskey's Wish the funding they need so they can continue on this great work in the land down under. And by the way, when I get there, and I'm holding you to this, Nina's coming with me. We'll bring our wives and our significant others. You're taking us to Ayers Rock, man. I want to go to Alice Springs so bad.
Right. Well, it'll be a bit of a trip, but we will get there.
No, I'm looking forward to that. But so they can go to that website. They can buy merchandise. I got to tell you, Jack, your story is...
They can donate if they really want to. Like, I'm not going to... You've got the freedom of speech and freedom of everything else over there, and I'm not going to tell an American not to donate to me.
No, we won't tell them either. So what is the message that you want to give? Give us some of your wisdom. What's the message you want non-veterans to know about combat veterans, and what do you want your brothers and sisters in uniform to know? Very quickly, you know what? Tell us your wisdom.
Well, my wisdom is if you see a veteran, get the fuck out of the road because they don't want to talk to you. No,
we get that.
Yeah, we won't use that one. I think what it is like just veterans. Well, I don't know. Veterans are, to me, should be respected for what they've done. It's more about when they've got an assistance dog or an assistance animal or a service dog in our case. Like, you know, don't interrupt their day by distracting the animal that's giving them the ability to do what everyone else, like most civilians, take for granted. And don't forget the sacrifice that these people made so that you can have that freedom. It's just... when you come to words of wisdom, there's not too many floating around my head. I could probably tell a couple of dirty jokes, but there's not much wisdom up there.
What about wisdom for your brothers and sisters in arms?
I'm doubting myself as to what wisdom is at the moment. Liz, have I got words of wisdom?
Not really.
Apparently not.
I'm inspired by all that you've done. You've done so much and have sacrificed so much, and you've come back and you've turned around your situation in order to help others. And what does freedom mean to you?
Freedom is being able to express yourself within reason. It's being able to get up every morning and do what you want to do. If you can have the career that you want. It's the ability to be able to walk down the street and not be scared that, you know, other people or other groups are going to attack you just because of your beliefs and the things that you like to do. And freedom's just, it's the ability to wake up every day and just get on with your life and not have to worry about, you know, people shouldn't be scared when they have like big events and that, you know, oh, maybe this is going to be targeted by a certain group or anything like that. No, freedom's just, well, it's like being a child. Like, they're the perfect example of what freedom is, the way they run around without a care in the world. And, you know, they're just innocent. And, you know, it'd be great if the world could go back, that adults could have the same outlook on life as children, but it probably not going to happen.
Well, that's great definition.
I do have a bit of wisdom then.
Absolutely. I just didn't know you do. And, you know, I just want to thank you for being here, Jacko, and there you have Scott Jackman from Whiskey's Wish, from the land down under, one of the greatest places in the world because of guys like you and ladies that have worn the uniform in Australia. And Liz behind the scenes and your son, God bless you. And, you know, you've humbled us to be on Straight Outta Combat today.
Oh, well, Liz said thank you. And thank you, John and Nina, for putting up with me and my eccentricities.
Hey, man.
Nope. We know that it's quite early there, given the time difference. So
our pleasure.
Oh, no, it's not really that early. But no, thanks for having me, and I'm honored and privileged to be the first Australian on your show.
God bless, mate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
No, thank you, guys. Before they burn it down, better dig deep, put them in the ground. Blood on their hands, yeah, they're hellbound. Sing us all.